All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are live. Welcome to episode 43 of Logos Academy.
Damn.
We're joined by Hammer today, and we're having some interesting technical problems that we'll explain here. So, Hammer's having some issue with his microphone. It's only coming through the left ear. If you guys are listening with earbuds, so I recommend that if you do listen to the show, just don't listen with earbuds. Play it on a speaker or your phone or something like that. And that should fix the audio issue. But if you are listening with earbuds and you only hear it on the left side, it's not your end, it's our end. So we do apologize for that. But we didn't want to postpone the show any further. So with that said, Hammer, welcome. It is nice to have you on again. It's been like 2 years, I think.
Hey, man, good to see you. And for the audience to be aware, we did not get in contact ahead of time on this clothing synchronicity that we got going right now. It's so great, but yeah, man, I love that. My mic might not be in sync, but our clothes are, so hail victory.
Yeah, we're good there. We're definitely good with the attire. So for my audience, because I mean, 2 years ago, my audience was probably very familiar with you, but being on the StuPeters Network now, we have a very different audience that's going to be listening in today who might not be familiar with you. So if you maybe want to just give like a brief kind of summary on who you are, what you stand for.
I mean, like a story of how I came to all this, or what we're doing exactly now. I mean, what, or both. I mean,
Yeah, maybe just bring up. Let's start with the organization, kind of what you're
okay,
doing,
cool.
what your role is, and then we'll back up actually, and we'll kind of explain how you got there too, and then we'll kind of go from
Perfect.
there.
So, Blood Tribe, or Blutstomp, is our organization. We started this, I think it was 2019 or so. And when I first started becoming public, I knew my actual intentions in starting was to find guys and try and build the cadre, try to survive. Actually, in the initial part was survive the collapse that I saw coming. That was mostly the strategy, was build up a crew that we can lean on in the coming days. So, how do you do that? That's a trick. It's very difficult. How do you get your name out there? How do you communicate your intentions to people and get them, how do you instill confidence in them for you? How do you keep the tribe together, build the culture of the tribe, the identity of the tribe? How do you organize the tribe? It's all a big trick. It's not easy, and there's a reason why, and no one else is really doing it very big. So that's what I did. And at first, the answer was doing any sort of activism I could, which was basically like stickers and banners. We did these big 10-foot by 10-foot banners that said no white guilt on them. We dropped them all over the country. It was like 150 of them total in one night. It was on we did it twice. The second time we did it on George Floyd's death anniversary, actually. So yeah, we trying to get the word out, trying to just talk to people as much as I can, get people interested, build that magnetism, filter them, find out who's good and who's bad, who's willing to work, who's got that will, who doesn't, put them under the same banner, and continue to express ourselves publicly so that people know we exist, to know that there's something worth participating in. And that's evolved more or less into a sort of an acceptance of a responsibility. Because now it starts to feel like, oh wait, no one else is really doing this. No one else is raising the banner but us. So we started to take ourselves a lot more seriously as far as our mission goes. And now it's less of a let's survive the collapse and more of a let's avoid a collapse. Let's win victory, right? So let's backwards engineer victory. Because I feel like the collapse cult stuff is almost like a cult of losers, like a victim club, as it's a support group for the end of days. And I don't want to be that. I want to offer solutions. I want to fix things. So that's really, you know, what we've evolved into doing in our mission statement. But essentially, yeah, we do what we do to basically find the right people that are willing to fight.
That's good. You know, in your intro here, you express that you want to state your intentions clearly, and I think maybe this platform is a good spot to do this because, you know, the Jewish system has done a very good job at obfuscating your intentions. You know, Laura Loomer has smeared you as a Democrat. You know, you're called feds by, you know, the mass media and all of these like normies, and these MAGA types are calling you Democrats, right? So, what are
Everything but
your
what we are. They'll say anything but what we are. Isn't that funny? Like,
Of
they
course.
come up with an infinite, the imagination is infinite. You know, they just let their imagination run wild and come up with all sorts of things. But yeah, I
So,
go ahead.
to clear the air here, what are your direct intentions? What are your motivations behind the group and the movement?
Okay, perfect. So, you know, obviously, what I want more than anything is for us to get our homeland back that our ancestors bled for, right? And I want to establish a new order that will replace this, what we've kind of existed in since the Civil War, this like tyranny of the federal government that has smushed us all down, but also in the process starts to do things like pumping infinite migrants in and giving Jews unlimited power and all that. But the Jew gets to use, you know, our flaws and take advantage of our flawed system, right? So the trick is replacing the system. What do we replace it with? A lot of people like to reference, you know, constitutional America. Which, you know, they're some of the smartest statesmen that ever existed. And I definitely have great pride in them. But there was places where that was lacking. And even in the days of the Constitution, it was very much debated. And it was not a landslide vote. The states did not. And in fact, the states required there to be modifications to the original Constitution in order for them to even sign on. So, to, you know, imply that there's some sort of infallible, divine inspiration for the Constitution that everyone in the past worshipped is not true. There's been lots of political debates since the beginning of this country on how we should go forward. The problem is now who has gotten control of it, right? And what those powers are capable of. So, what do we replace it with? Well, in my opinion, I believe National Socialism is the final evolution of political thought. I would argue that they, you know, were inspired in a lot of ways by American statesmen, and that their project was built upon ours. It's a collective consciousness thing. We're all working on things together as Europeans. So it's not strictly Germanic. It is a good system for good reasons. And primarily, it is because of the war on financial slavery. And that is the reason it is mostly demonized, is because our emancipation will only come through finance, our own freedom from financial Judaistic slavery. So yeah, we're looking to instill National Socialism, looking to represent it and to build it, to educate our guys on the fundamentals of it, and to you know, spread that message and get more people's eyes looking towards that ideology as an answer, normalizing the swastika, normalizing National Socialism, etc.
Yeah, it's a very good explanation, especially on why it's demonized, you know, why they are so hard against this. And you know, you see this historically with United States presidents as well. Every president that they've tried to assassinate or has had some kind of problem with assassination attempts was someone who messed with the currency, right? Lincoln did the greenbacks. You look back at Andrew Jackson, he got rid of the second Bank of America, I think it was. JFK, he tried to that executive order, which kind of offset the Federal Reserve, and all of these people are the ones they've... even you look at non-white countries like Gaddafi, you know, same deal. He tries to do a currency that's away from their central banking system, and they have to demonize it. They have really no choice because that's how they get their control.
And it's a tricky... The Jew really excels in places of... obfuscation and confusion. They really excel there because they start to endorse and embrace every side of all the arguments. And the problem with economics is it is very confusing, and it's not an exact science. And people desperately have been trying to figure out money and finances for a long time, and especially in this country. I'm a big fan of early... late 19th century, early 20th century Mississippi history. A lot of those politicians were, even in the same party, arguing pretty hard on what to do with currency. So it has been a trick to master for a long time. But I believe that National Socialism cracked the code, and we need to lean into it.
Yeah, I agree. So... for those in the audience that might not understand National Socialism, although I would hope if you watch this show, you do by this point. I mean, we're reading Mein Kampf on the show live, so you should get it by now. But if you don't get it, maybe if you want to give your own explanation of National Socialism, which is really interesting because we've just had an overt National Socialist on Wednesday as well with the European awesome. Ethos Project. He's really knowledgeable on these things, so... if you want to also explain, because I think it would help for the audience to hear several people give their take on National Socialism. They've heard mine, they've heard his. Now, if they can hear yours, I think that would help.
Absolutely. I mean, for a few reasons. One, we're all working on this project together, right? Speaking of the collective consciousness thing, we're working on this together, and we need to figure out exactly how we want American National Socialism to look like together, and we need to agree upon that. So it's very important for us all to talk about it at great length. And not only that, but the fact that it is a very deep subject. It's not as simple as other political ideologies because there's a lane for every little thing, right? I mean, they would put, all the industries, they would have Führers for these different industries, and they'd be organized, and within each one of those industries there's different examples to follow, different things to learn from, and there's a wealth of literature to read, incredible depth. It's not like fascism, which is very simple in comparison, probably could be summarized in 10 pages. It's not really a comparable thing, but National Socialism is very deep and dynamic. I would say it's more of akin to a spirituality or even religion. Religion's kind of a dirty word these days, but it's more of a spiritual walk than anything because essentially the intentions are what can we do to maximize the health of our folk, the prosperity of our folk, the sovereignty of our folk, the strength of our folk, right? And where all are those things applied in, like, genetics and, the strength of the mother, right? Building up of our industries, simple things like building roads, which was a big deal at the time. But I would say it's mostly a system of priorities overall, prioritizing your folk first, and a clean, happy, Aryan life. But there's also the beautiful side of it being a freedom from Jewish power. And essentially what they did was they observed the Jew and how the Jew takes power. Because think about it. The Jew has taken power in every single different type of government system that's ever existed. They have found a way to infiltrate monarchy. They have found a way to infiltrate communism. They have found a way to infiltrate American liberalism, American conservatism. Every single solitary political system in China itself has been infiltrated by the Jews. So they had to figure out, how do we crack this code? How do we build something that doesn't benefit the Jew? And even the scheming, most scheminist, manipulative Jewish entities wouldn't have power, because they didn't have the ability to take the reins of our system. And through that, mostly, is the finances and creating a currency that they can't manipulate and speculate in, and removing different things like land speculation, busting trusts up, and nationalizing large monopolistic industries, stuff like that. But then also just simple things like a war on their cultural perversions, you know, like the homosexual propaganda, right, or the disgusting modern art, all those sorts of things. It's a multifaceted front against the basically the degradation of our folk, which is clear to anyone who is spiritually worth talking about and knowing. Anyone that's a good person, it is abundantly clear that we are suffering in a massive downward spiral. So it's just a beautiful system, in my opinion, that has an answer for all of these problems in one banner. And that is the reason why it is the most demonized. That is the reason why people shock when they see that banner and nothing else. It's because America was a very racist country. Okay. It was a very racist country. And I would argue, in a lot of ways, it was more racist than the Third Reich Germany. And in fact, when you read interviews of black POWs under German soldiers, they attest to the fact that the Germans treat them better than their own white soldiers. I'm not saying that this is necessarily a bad thing. I'm a fan of racism. But what I'm really getting at is, you have a country that was incredibly racist, the South especially, which was where all the blacks were, you know, that was pushing for segregation all the way into the 70s, elected politicians dropping N-bombs well after the World War II. So if America is an extremely racist country, it wasn't a righteous war against racism of any kind. It was a war against a system of financial freedom, and the Jews didn't want to allow that.
Yeah, that's actually a good assessment, too, that America was more racist than the Third Reich. You know, the Third Reich actually was pretty liberal on a lot of their policies. You know, they even went as far as to accept Jews that were 25%, you know, something like that.
Yes. In the South had a one-drop rule for Negro blood. Did you know that?
Yeah.
If you had any Negro ancestor, you were considered a full Negro. Sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, I agree with you. You know, and it shows that National Socialism was actually very liberal in some cases. Actually, I would argue too much so. I think, especially when we're talking about the Jewish problem, 25%, well, we see how that works, you know. It's people are 5% Jewish, and they identify with that Jewish aspect very strongly. Yeah. So you have to be very careful when it comes to Jewish blood specifically. I want to talk maybe a little bit about racialism and the importance of it, because I think this is also, unfortunately, a very hard concept for a lot of our people to wrap their minds around. They're very emotionally attached to this idea of it being, you know, something that's evil or immoral in some way, shape, or form. You know, we see very recently this situation with this young lad, Austin, who was stabbed by this this black kid at this event. And you see the reaction, the mass reaction of blacks, you know, basically boasting that a white boy deserved it. You know, they're donating thousands of dollars to this cause. And still, there are some white people that are looking at this, and their reaction is to call these blacks racist. Like, what they don't realize is the blacks don't care about being called that like our people do. You can't emotionally browbeat them with that. So Racialism, what does that mean to you, and why is this such an important concept?
First of all, it means there's a lot of stuff going on under that's a big umbrella. But racialism, for me, as far as what it means to me the most, is, as far as what I'm struggling for, is that I do believe that the white race, the Aryan race, whatever you want to call us, the Nordic race, whatever, Anglo-Saxon, I do believe that we are worthy of, remaining on this country and on this planet. Right? I believe that we deserve to exist, and we are an extreme minority. So the only way that we are going to exist is if we make sure that we don't have proximity to non-whites going forward, and that we prioritize our folk and breeding and all of that. And the introduction of alien subspecies of hominids will taint that blood forever, and it is irreversible. So it's a very, very serious thing to deal with. Does that mean that we necessarily have hatred for other races? Not necessarily, but our hatred doesn't come from a place of them being different. In fact, as white people, we actually enjoy different exotic stuff. And look at that funny Negro, But that's not where the hatred comes from, which is what our enemies want to portray our hatred as, is just a fear of something different, or just a distaste for something different. It's not the case at all. The hatred is due to their behavior and us desiring accountability for that behavior, and that accountability not being present. And that hatred is never going to go away, because the crimes keep stacking. They just keep stacking generationally. So I even argue sometimes that the modern racist is actually, on average, way more racist than slave-owning Americans were back in the day. And I'll say that because I've read their literature, and the things that they say is it's a more paternalistic. They were trying to take care of these people. They just saw them as inferior and wanted to help them, and they had their little things or whatever. And, oh, well, it's not their fault that they're like that. We're just going to give them a purpose and something to do, right? Whereas the average racist today is, we hate them. We don't want them anywhere near us. They are dangerous. They have done too much to us. The scales of justice need to be leveled. And the reason I'm trying to make that distinction is because there's obviously a hatred that we have, but racialism isn't necessarily married to hatred. And in fact, racialism in the past didn't really have a whole lot of hatred. You know why it didn't have hatred? Because we had white supremacy. We had the power. We had the ability still and the willpower to protect our folk and maintain things like, laws on miscegenation, etc. Because they had strong white supremacy, they didn't have that threat on the horizon. We don't have that strong white supremacy, and we've had a lot more things happened to us since because of the forced proximity to such a massive population of non-whites everywhere we exist. So, yeah, obviously I believe in a white supremacy in the term of, yeah, we're superior to them. I do believe that. I don't believe it's necessarily we're superior to all other subspecies of hominids because of our intellect or anything, as much as I actually believe that we are most superior to them in our spirit, in our honor, and that reflects the way that we treat each other. It reflects our own interests and priorities, like the reason liberty does mean something to the white man, freedom, being free to be a person and not be stamped down like the people in China or Japan, et cetera, because those people are, they're creative to some measure. They're very intelligent. But the difference would be, I think, in defining our superiority is the honor. And you can study our languages and our history and our art and literature to find that honor everywhere you look. But I think that Really, though, at the end of the day, if I was inferior, if we were inferior and there was a more superior hominid, I would still want to have my own place. I would still want us to maintain our purity and maintain what we are, because I think that what we are is worth saving.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's very unique. There's a couple pieces that you brought up that I think are really important. First off, this explanation of racialism not necessarily implying hatred, because this is a big confusion, you know. And I talk about this a lot on my show, and I say I grew up in a racist family, in the sense that I had family members that were, you know, no blacks in the house, you know, I don't want you having any black friends, things like that, which was them protecting me. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't see it that way, but I appreciate it now. But I would not consider them racialist because they didn't care about their roots. They didn't care about their people, their traditions, their heritage. They had no self-identity. They only could see other. And that to me is just, that's just like low IQ racism. When
Right, it's like
racialism,
instinctual.
When racialism is more of this, well, you said it pretty well. It's more of a spiritual ideal, right? It recognizes that where you come from is very important. You know, God created all of these different racial categories, and it's our necessity to keep those things pure as much to our extent as we can. And another piece that you mentioned that I think is also super important is this framing of fear that the Jewish media does, that, well, we don't want other races here because we're scared of them, right? Or we're scared of change, or we're scared of a different atmosphere. They do this with everything, you know, homophobia. I'm not afraid of gay people. I'm disgusted by them. You know, it's not,
Repulsed,
right? It's not a phobia. So that's a really big one, because that's how even the left, when they see somebody like you or myself, who, you know, is very open about our racial instincts, they have this reaction of, oh, you're scared. You're scared to be friends with black people, or you're scared to see their cultures. And, well, I'm not scared of them. I just know that they're dangerous and they're different than I am. And you know, even when you look at Asiatics, Asiatics aren't dangerous. I'm not afraid. Like when I go in a building and there's like 50 Asian people, I'm not scared I'm gonna get stabbed. I'm not worried about violence, but they're different than me. I still don't want to be around people that are different than me. It's as simple as that.
You know, a good example that I like to bring up is the handshake. Why do non-whites suck at giving handshakes? What is going on? Where is the disconnect between the hand and the head? And what exactly is that? Is there a lack of confidence? Is there a lack of respect for me as a man that you wouldn't just like stiffen up a little bit? How come an old white woman can give me a better handshake than a Pajit? It's the weirdest thing in the world, right? But it is true. It's very true. In fact, you know it's true because when you go to shake a non-white's hand and they don't have a terrible handshake, you are surprised. And that means it's an exception, and it's exceptional, and it sticks out to you. So the exception proves the rule. So why is it? You know, it's just another example of there's this tribal interconnectivity that we have, this different form of respect and nobility that we the way we treat each other that they don't have at all. The average person to them doesn't mean much because why? Because they don't see themselves as much, right? So they treat you that same way. But with us, right, we want to say yes, sir, no, sir. We want to hold the door for folks, even if they're not necessarily people we like. You know, it's like, dude, if somebody's walking up behind me, it's hard for me to not hold the door, even if it's a non-white, because I just feel like I'm betraying my own honor by but these are just different characteristics that, you know, define, I believe, our spiritual quality. And when the average starts to be less of what we are and more of what they are, you can tell, it's very apparent that the overall quality of all these things just spirals down the shitter.
Yeah, I concur. You know, a really good example of this too, you talk about holding the door for somebody and just having that like altruistic value to you. This is a very European character, and the best way you can ever actually see this for yourself, anybody that wants to view this distinction, go to Walmart. Any Walmart, they're like the most multicultural fucking stores in the world. So go to any Walmart and walk around the aisles and watch as you go down an aisle and you have any race of people that are standing there with their cart, blacks, Indians, Mexicans, they will not move their cart instinctively. But you can go down that same aisle and if a white person has their cart in the way, it's like they have this crazy, like, eyes in the back of their head kind of peripheral vision where they just
Not even thinking
instinctively
about it.
movement, they just pull the cart away, right? It's like intrinsic. It's super instinctive. I've noticed that so many times going out to stores, and I just every time it shocks me because I can't tell you how many times I go to down an aisle and there's like blacks on the cell phone talking in Spanish or something, and they almost want to be in your way. You know, like you're very clearly trying to get through and they have zero care or interest in the fact that somebody is moving here. They're very world revolves around them kind of a concept. And this is a product, by the way, of not living in civilized nations for thousands of years. We've lived in civilization for so long, it's now genetically inbred into us, or not inbred, but genetically ingrained into us to be civil, to be caring about people around you.
Well, it's also how the hierarchy functions. So the non-white hierarchy is more based on this like posturing, and these dominance rituals, these like very primitive dominance rituals that they do. Like for example, a black just staring at you until you look away, and it's just like, dude, I got other things to do to stare at you. So yeah, I don't know what we're doing this love lock, thing together right now, but they do that. But they operate like that because that's how their own hierarchies are not only how they function, but how they're created. Whereas our hierarchies, for who knows how long, have been based on what, once again, honor, nobility, behaving with a different air, right? You didn't get respect for just, posturing and bullying people around you. You got respect because you behaved like a noble person. You considered the people around you actually, and you tried to work in their interests. So yeah, it's just like their whole, weird thing. Another thing is like how Asian people stand real close to you. I hate that.
Well, that's very much a part of them, right? They have this Asians
No
are
personal
very
space.
very ant-like. I've heard them described as such, and it's a very good description because they just kind of fit into place. Like they were the ones when COVID was going on, unless they were super Americanized Asians, all of them were wearing masks. Every single one of them. They're very conformist, you know? They just kind of bottle into that. I have to point out someone in the chat made me laugh. He said, "I'm a non-white cart rammer."
I mean, so that's the thing is they know that white, so like he said, white people instinctively are respecting each other's surroundings and they try to move. Well, so imagine you're a posturing non, and that's your thing is to posture all the time. You have learned over time that the white people will just get out of your way. And it starts to become a game to you in a way. Right, let's just make them get out of the way. Whereas we're over here, like we got shopping to do, man. What are you trying to create some sort of pecking order right here on this aisle between the Doritos and the Frosted Flakes? But I got shit to do, But to them, it's like, yeah, this is my moment. I'm gonna show them,
You know,
So yeah.
that's a very good point, because I actually experienced this. I went with a friend of mine to Philadelphia, and I'm not a city guy. I despise cities for the simple reason that they're multicultural cesspools. And we parked in this parking garage, and apparently there was a sign outside that said no cash, and I didn't see this sign. And I only do cash. I don't do like debit cards and things like that. And we're pulling out, and there's this fucking Indian guy working the booth at the end, right? And they have one of those electric gates where they have to press the button to go up. And there's like a ticket thing, and I click the support button, and it puts up a. First off, the Indian guy's on the opposite side of the garage, so he's not even there to help me right now. So I have to hit this live support thing on this fucking ticket booth. And it brings up this like video camera window, and it's some Mexican lady like, "How can I help you?" And I'm like, "Dude, I don't have, all I have is cash. I don't have a card, so I can't do this whole ticket process. I'm like, I just want to give somebody cash. You can't help me. You're across the world, probably, right? Yeah. And so the Indian guy finally comes over, and he's like, what? How do I help? What? Barely speaks a lick of English, right? And I'm like, I only have cash. He goes, we do not take cash, sir. I said, yeah, but no. I'm telling you, though, like, I only have cash. I don't have a card, so I can't physically pay you to get out of here. He goes, we do not take the cash, sir. It's all he could say, and he just kept repeating it and repeating it. And the thing is, what they're used to is the average white person in these, like, you know, city areas is very liberal, and they'll just go, oh, I'm so sorry, it's my mistake. I'll back my car up, I'll call my mom, and she'll come bring a debit card. You know, I'm not doing that. Like, you're going to take the cash, it's legal tender, or I'm gonna fucking sit here and block your thing. He starts taking pictures of my license plate, and you know, he's calling his manager up on the phone, and I was genuinely I was screaming at him to let me out of the parking garage. It wouldn't budge. So, of course, how was it solved? I walked like 4 feet up the ramp, and there was a group of white construction workers, and I gave them cash, and one of them swiped their card for me. But I told them I don't have cards, and I'm not using a card. So you're gonna. You're either accepting my cash or I'm going to block this all day. And they're not used to that. That's what they need to experience, you know.
Right.
And this is why
it's unfortunate that you have to be like that, because in our systems, if there was a white guy working there, like, all right, cool, let me figure out how to make this work. And then, you know, make an exception for you, push the button to manually raise it, and then, you know, it'd have been over. But since it's this uppity-ass Pajit, right, he's got to make a whole, like, this is his victory hill.
Yeah, he's posturing, like you said, right? So, and this is the important thing, is we have, again, that intrinsic altruism that we have inside of us. We have to learn to train that to be specifically for our people, right? And,
yes.
And when we train it in that fashion, and we stop wasting our energy, because, by the way, that's spiritually draining. Like, when you hold a door for some black dude, because it just feels intrinsic to do, and he doesn't even say thank you or acknowledge that you held him. You know, like, you're like, okay, fuck you, too. You know, like, it's just, we have to train that altruism for our own.
Yes, selective, right? But, you know, hopefully, before the end of it, our people will only be around their own, so they won't have to do too much overthinking. It's just the unfortunate reality of living the world we do in a environment unlike anything that our folk have ever experienced before. And it's actually a massive social experiment that the elites are conducting, right? It is an experiment. We don't know how it's going to end. And, we'll just see. You know, what's interesting about saying that is that, you know, there's this Jew that was leading the charge on changing racial science in America, Professor Boaz, who taught at, I forgot the university, taught tens of thousands of students who went on to go, you know, infiltrate all sorts of levels of, not infiltrate, but literally just get hired to be, you know, the proto DEI teams of all, every branch of an organization in the country. But even him would say that this goal of miscegenation has an unknown outcome. So even the forefather of their own thoughts agree that this is a science experiment that they're conducting. They don't know the result of it. Anyone who's intelligent would have to admit that there is no way to know what the result of all this would be, what the end product is after a couple hundred years. And to align yourself with the struggle to create a system with an unknown result is the most ludicrous thing I can imagine, especially going as far as spilling your blood for it, which is the willingness to spill your blood is the lifeblood of a nation. The only reason that it exists is that there are men that are willing to sacrifice themselves in the name of the law. So how are you going to create that loyalty with an experiment that it has an unknown conclusion we're going towards something, who knows, right? Like, how do you steer that ship?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And you know, on that same note, what's very interesting is this experiment, if we're to let's just say we're to give it a shot, right? Oh, let's play the multicultural experiment and see how it goes. Well, if the end result is bad, this isn't something that you can reverse. That's the danger about the experiment, right? And this is a global experiment. You know, there is no white country untouched by said experiment. Which is the most important piece here. You can't go back on racial miscegenation. It's not like, oh, I'll just, you know, undo that a couple times. You can't do that. So this is something with far-reaching consequences that cannot be reversed. So if the end result is negative, which I think just by the living circumstances, it's pretty clear to see that it will be. We're now seeing from having enough of these people in our countries, it's causing nothing but strife and conflict amongst all of the different nations. So
Well,
it's
we
very
have
clear.
examples. You know, we have examples. We have the different empires that have collapsed due to miscegenation, which are many. Like India, for example. India, the Aryans that invaded and dominated India had laws on miscegenation. They had a religion based on not allowing miscegenation. It was enforced with like death penalties. It was the most extreme, and obviously nothing that we're going to ever do, but the proximity was still enough to make it collapse, crumble, and turn into what it is now, which is absolutely repulsive. Look at Egypt. Egypt was started by white dudes. They started letting the nons come in over the years, degrades, lose power. Look at everything south of our border here. Mexico, South America, everywhere in between. It is a part of that experiment. The Spanish went down there, they didn't bring women, they bred all of the brown ladies, made a whole mongrel nation, has any sort of magnificent, spectacular humanity been birthed out of this commingling of so many different races? Because there's many different races came together in South America. So if the argument is diversity of biological input increases the good, then that would mean that they would be peak because they have the most diverse input of blood into their populace. But instead, it's the worst. Brazil is like the most dangerous place in the world. It's more dangerous than any single African country. You're more likely to get murdered in Brazil than anywhere in Africa. So you're safer living with god dang jungle monkeys in Africa than you are with the mongrels of Brazil. There's no example anywhere of the mongrelization leading to some utopian paradise that we're all going to march towards hand in hand. And there's many, many examples of empires that have totally collapsed and went to ruin, and countries that have totally turned into hellscapes because of it.
Yeah, it's very well said. I just want to address, we got someone in the chat here. No pretenders. I don't have anything to do with that program or what's going on over there. I just run a show on the network, so I personally can't help you. I'm sorry for whatever issue you're having. You'll have to try to contact Stu directly. But I do want to. We're about halfway through the show, so I want to take a brief little intermission just to address the chats, and then we'll kick
Cool.
back to the conversation. So, folks, if you guys are watching, make sure that you share around. A friendly reminder as well, if you're just coming in and you're having some audio issues, because I do see a couple people have mentioned something. We're having audio problems on Hammer's end. So, if you're listening with earbuds, you're only going to hear us out of the left ear. It's not your earbuds doing that. It's not the stream. It's unfortunately just a small tech problem. So, I recommend unplug the earbuds. Just listen through a cell phone or a speaker or something like that. That'll fix the problem. Just make sure that if you guys are not following already, you follow on everything. Make sure you're following Hammer too. We're going to promote his Twitter in just a second here so you
Thank
guys
you.
can follow him. If you guys are enjoying this conversation and the show, pop a super chat into the chat. We'll address super chats in real time. Those are always greatly appreciated. Best way to support the show. With that said, let's Hammer, if you want to give them your Twitter, and then we'll hop back into conversation a little bit here.
Yeah, so my Twitter handle, let me check. I had to just make a new one. So it's YEEE underscore OLE underscore hammer. Yo hammer. I have to make a new one every couple weeks because I get banned so much on this stupid thing.
Make sure you guys are following him before he gets gassed again. It's only a matter of time.
Is, yeah.
So I
I had to
actually
stop
want to.
buying the Premium Plus because it's $40 a month now. I have to go
Oh, and
down to
you just
regular
lose it each
Premium.
time?
Yeah,
Oh,
like last account lasts
shut
10 days, so I paid $40 for 10 days of
They should
use.
refund
So
you if you
stupid.
get banned. That's
I agree, but they keep charging you if you don't go back and cancel that subscription.
really, that's
Yeah.
typical. Very typical.
Yeah. What were you saying? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, you're right. I want to back us up a little bit and go into your organization a little bit and talk a little
Sure.
more. I think people are probably familiar with you somewhat now. I want to talk a little bit about your organization and what you guys are doing to hopefully raise some awareness and again some clarity because from an outsider's point of view, if the only thing you've seen about Blood Tribe is through Twitter, you probably think
Right.
that they're a bunch of like Patriot Front, right? You probably think they're a bunch of
Yeah.
feds who are Democrat hired, right? Or
Yeah.
Jewish funded or whatever nonsense
Or
people are spewing
American.
all over. So first off, what kind of you guys have done a lot of activism in the past. So what kind of activism do you guys do? Do you have any new activism planned for the future? What's your goal with the activism that you are doing?
Now, we're always changing and trying to figure out the best step forward. We started off really hitting the LGBT, like the drag queen story hour stuff. We hit that pretty hard in Ohio, and basically they don't even throw those anymore. It's all behind closed doors. They definitely don't do them outside and in public anymore because of us. So we were hitting that for a while, but the problem with scheduling things like that that I was noticing, especially after the last couple, was that I've got these guys traveling very far, putting a lot of sacrificing a lot for each one of these events. And if we just end up going to some drag queen thing and it's just like a kind of a whatever, it's like a missed opportunity of the use of those resources to create something historic, you know. So that's when we started to hit the capitals, the state capitals. The state capitals to me have a very historic quality. My goal is to hit all of them. Maybe not Alaska and Hawaii, but all of them in the continental US. And at the end, once we've done that, hit DC. And ho the hope is that we have thousands of guys at that time, and then we go to DC. This is like a 10-year project in total to do because we do once a quarter we do these. Now we also have things that we do in between that fall under. So those major four events are national events. But the way I have things structured is that each region has its own jarl, its own president essentially. And those regions will throw their own events, which we've had a couple done in Ohio so far. But my goal with that system and have the constitution that I've made is that we have these different levels of hierarchy that engage in the activism in their own local areas based upon the guidance and the inspiration of our, you know, our past. So things like going to a drag queen thing, going here, going there, that might not have the big historical quality, isn't as much of a risk on the local guys. So they're not, if they only have to drive a couple hours, it's really not that big deal to go hit a drag queen thing, right? So, you know, that recently they did a couple times, they hit the Springfield, Ohio, issue, which is a massive invasion of Haitians that occurred there. It was, I think, 30,000 Haitians into a town of about the same people, same amount of people or less. And the townspeople were freaking out about it. We were watching their city councils and getting to know the situation. it was really early on in the awareness of this, and we decided to go out there because, you know, we have a lot of guys in Ohio. We're known for Ohio. So the local leadership decided to schedule a couple things, went there, and one thing led to another. The cat eating stuff, because the Haitians are eating all the neighborhood cats and the ducks and the chickens from the park, not chickens, the ducks and geese from the park. They're just like feasting on random animals they encounter. And that was a part of, you know, the meme warfare that was engaged in that, you know, it spread like wildfire pretty quick. And it ended up resulting with Trump mentioning the Haitian invasion and the cat eating specifically on the debate stage for the presidency. And later on, he actually revoked the refugee status for 570,000, I believe, Haitians in this country. So hopefully our work has led to the deportation of over 500,000 absolute disgusting third world savages. That is a good example of the initiative that I want to create at the lower levels of leadership, because I didn't even do anything there. I didn't have to. They took the reins, made it happen, and they deserve all the credit for an incredible accomplishment. We're currently being sued for, so after this went to the national stage, this town received a lot of harassment from just, I mean, you can imagine, people are mad. They're just going to do whatever they can and do crazy stuff. I mean, they just swatted that one poor kid's father yesterday, Austin Metcalf, is that it? Austin Metcalf's father. So people are just, when they're mad, they do all kinds of crazy stuff. They did, I don't think there was a swatting in Springfield, but they did a bunch of prank calls and stuff like that. And they're trying to blame, or at least sue us for, every single one of these individual pieces of harassment that the town received. And that's being funded by the ADL and the law firm Paul Weiss, whatever you want to say. So that's an example of some activism we've done. We've done other things kind of like in the middle. But going forward, my vision is to have the big four main rallies on Capitol steps annually and incentivize local leadership to engage with local activism at their own level and area. And we'll see what happens, man. I think that it's a good system. You know, systems, following a system, having a plan is important. And yeah, you know, people could argue that there's better plans, but, you know, like, ultimately you just got to do something. So I'm not going to hate on you for having a different plan. Please go engage with that plan and follow through with it to the utmost. That's really what it takes, is follow through, showing up and follow through. So that's our plan there, is to do the same.
Well, it sounds like a very solid plan. And I have to say, you know, one of my favorite things that I saw was when you went to one of these drag queen things and you said, pedos or Nazis, pick one. I think that was what the banner said. That is the most brilliant polarization in the world, because it's so potent. Like, if you're a normie, how do you look at that and go, shit? like it's such a clear answer, right? What you have to go to. If you're really, you hate Nazis that much that you're going to go support pedophiles, you've got to be out of your mind. You have to be literally insane.
That was at Wadsworth. That banner, though, officially, we got to give credit to White Lives Matter for that. That was their banner. But us and White Lives Matter, we stood side by side. We threw Romans and screamed the same chants together the whole time. So it was a real nice united front against, I mean, it was a crazy day, bud. I mean, you could never plan another day like that again. It was just the perfect storm. You know, we tried chasing that perfect storm after, but it just wasn't happening, because the event had got out and there was all kinds of protesters. There was probably 200 protesters total, but they all hated us. So we were protesting them and the drag queens at the same time, screaming at every direction. I blew my voice all the way out. It was incredible. It blew up. The media went everywhere, and that guy is no longer running drag queen shows.
Good.
Who was throwing that? The guy who was throwing that.
See, that's what's so important, you know, and I think a lot of people fail to recognize that is these people that are doing these things, the drag queen story hour and all this stuff, they're intrinsically, they're weak people. They're weak and feeble, pathetic, slimy people. That's why they're targeting children. They're sick in the head, really. And all they need is healthy backlash. The reason they weren't doing this in America in the 1940s is because white authority actually ruled this country, and it would have told them, no, you're not fucking doing that. The police would have came in and beaten them with clubs, for Christ's sake, back then, right? Same with even black behavior in America. You know, people like to point back at blacks in the 40s and 50s and go, oh, well, they were doing so much better before rap culture. Well, you can't attribute all that to rap culture. What you have to attribute it to is the fact that they were under the control of a very serious system that would have penalized them for bad behavior. Yeah. They're not being penalized for it now, right? This kid just stabs somebody in the chest, and he's praised. He's getting thousands of dollars of donations. They're not receiving the accurate backlash because there is no white authority to step in and make those decisions.
No. The chain is left unbroken. It's like being a bastard son with no father, you know. A good example of the degeneracy part was a book. I was reading a book yesterday on stream, Theodore Bilbo's Separation and Mongrelization. And he was talking, I think it was in 1942 or something, there was this author that wrote a book that was just so awful and degenerate sexually. And I think it involved miscegenation too. It was vile. And they outlawed it and charged a guy in Massachusetts for selling it criminally, right? Like he was distributing this contraband. That wasn't that long ago, right? We had laws against just the written word being too degenerate, you know? So, yeah, that order is gone now. And our enemies run wherever they get an inch, they take a mile. Wherever they can get a crack, they drive a wedge. They always go as hard as they can on in their little respective evil lanes that we allow them to go.
Yeah, and this is why they just need adequate backlash, because they won't do the things that they're doing if they feel that they're going to be attacked or even just not attacked, but combated. Like somebody is there saying, no, we're not allowing this, we're not going to stand for this. You know, they're so used to this like milquetoast conservative kind of reaction where they just go on their talk show and go, oh, well, the trannies are at it again, we need to vote for Trump so that he can stop these trannies, you know, we got to put legislation in. And it's like that's not how all of this works, you know. And those people aren't scared. Well, clearly they're not scared of them. You never hear them saying, oh, conservatives are terrifying, but they're very scared of the evil Nazis, right? Because those are the people that actually know what's going on. They know why it's happening, and they care to stop it. They're outright care to stop it. There's no questioning it or you know, asking them politely.
A good example, I think, in America is the anti-lynching bills, which were fought by a lot of the great American politicians of the past, and it's interesting because these are the politicians that are invested in law and order in their own constituency. They don't necessarily advocate for lynching, but they were afraid that to make this some sort of extra offense, like there's people trying to say that lynchers deserve the death penalty, etc., that basically you're just going to take away that one punishment that exists, that cultural punishment we've probably been doing forever. We've probably always lynched people. And it wasn't just blacks that got lynched. In fact, I think the KKK lynched like 1,200 white folks in its period of time that's recorded. And that's just the KKK. People were lynching before the KKK. So, you know, the egregious crimes that get committed, the community being able to just be outraged, and you get kind of this collective consent between the community that we're going to do something about this right now, and the removal of that little biological function of the Aryan race has been very detrimental to our safety.
Yeah, and specifically the psychological removal. This is one of the hardest pieces is, you know, it's not even necessarily the physical removal itself, but the fact that people now think it's immoral to behave in such a fashion. You know, because if you are going to murder somebody, and in your mind you think, shit, what happens when I murder somebody is a bunch of people are going to string me up and hang me in the middle of town in front of everyone.
Yeah.
You really are going to think twice about murdering that person. But when you think, hey, if I murder this person, I'm going to go to jail. I get to hang out with my homies, play basketball, get some tattoos, watch television, have a nice free meal every day. There's not a lot of reason to second guess. There's no actual fear factor to behave correctly. And, you know, the same goes... I'm losing my example. I had a very good example that I wanted to bring up. I'm losing it though.
Dang.
Completely lost.
Well, good example I found today was just a Negro. He's sitting in a car. He just shot four kids at a high school, and he's just talking about, yeah, I had to do that, man, because you know they were threatening my life, or whatever. And it is what it is. I'll go to jail now, whatever. You know, and he said he was afraid for his life, so that affected his decision making, right? So obviously, fear for his life affected his decision making. That means going to jail wasn't necessarily a fear for his life. Going to jail to him didn't equal death. But back to what we were talking about at the beginning, when it comes to Aryans, liberty, freedom, these things to us mean so much more. So the fear of jail, it feels like death, but to them it doesn't.
No.
Right. Yeah. They're very okay being slaves. They were slaves for a long time with no major revolts of any kind. I mean, there was like uprising in some of the slave markets that the Jews were running, like the breeding camps and stuff like that, like the really, you know, nasty things the Jews were up to. They did some, but for the most part, man, Mammy was feeding the baby Aryans with the bottle and changing the diapers. And yes, sir, no, sir, huh? Yeah, I shod the horse today, sir. You know, like they were 100% okay with being slaves. They were actually happy being slaves. But an Aryan, and for many generations and everywhere that they've ever been enslaved, I mean, not just us have enslaved them, Arabs have enslaved them, et cetera. But for us, though, slavery just is equal to death. And you look at things like, I believe Tacitus talks about the Germanic tribes who would refuse to surrender in any way, and it was they would fight to the last man, and if you turned around and fought, the women behind you would kill you, and if all the men died, all the women would kill themselves. So what does that mean? That means they value, they knew if they lose, they'd become slaves. They valued that freedom to the utmost, and that slavery was death. In fact, slavery was worse than death, right?
Yeah.
Death was preferred. So they don't think like that.
I think to an extent those values have been very heavily depleted in our people through, you know, living in this extremely Jewish system. I'm now remembering the example I had. Which is a perfect...
Well, liberty itself has been redefined to them. So that's one of the tricks that's been played on them, is that they've been convinced that they're free and that their freedom includes the infinite choices of what to watch on Netflix and all of the different exotic foods they get to eat at whatever night delivered to their house through Uber Eats. But, you know, the fact that you can't have, like, a multi-generational homestead started tomorrow or probably the rest of your life escapes them completely, right? So the fact that they don't have the ability to have their own self-sovereignty or freedom from the Jewish slavery escapes them completely, because they have this false sense of liberty, or they can choose any kind of weird lifestyle choice that they want, right? But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, you're right. Physical liberties, not spiritual liberties. That's really
right.
Important. But the example I was thinking of earlier, where you can really see how this psychologically has broken down our sense of justice and understanding of things, is these new waves of vigilante pedo hunters. Have you seen these guys that like go around?
Yeah.
They catch them and they clobber the shit out of them in like a local store, and they scream at the top of their lungs, "This guy's here to meet a 13-year-old girl." You know, that. Do you think that guy is gonna think twice now before going to meet a child again? Because I've watched a lot of these like pedo hunter videos, and not just the ones that go and do it vigilante style, but the ones that like do it more kosher on YouTube, and they go and they work with the police and things like this.
Mm.
Almost none of them get arrested. Almost none of these pedophiles get arrested.
Right.
Most of the police go, "Oh, well, the way our county works, we can't do it this way, so you can give us the evidence and we can make a case file about it, but we can't guarantee anything's going to happen." It's like all this legal red tape. Meanwhile, you just clobber that guy a couple times.
They haven't actually like committed a crime. They've only chatted in a chat and with a, you know, so yeah.
It's like intent to commit a crime, right? So it's very like obscure, but it's clear that if that person had the chance, they would have been fucking a child that day. And you know, if they get clobbered by some dude and publicly embarrassed in front of a whole store of people, they're going to think twice before doing it again. But if they get this little slap on the wrist from the police where they're like, "You know, you shouldn't have done that, buddy."
Mm-hmm.
They don't care, you know? So
even the ones that get caught for completing the act don't get that much time. And
no, they don't. Yeah, it's very weak.
Really good. Yeah. It's just another thing that the old lynch mob could have fixed. The old lynch mob.
Yeah.
I mean, dude, there was this one, I think it was a pair of Negroes in Mississippi that raped and killed some man's family while he was gone. And they burned them alive at the stake and then shoved clay up their nose so they wouldn't asphyxiate. I mean, that sends a message, you know? People are taking this seriously. You know, you might end up with a whole crowd of people dressed in their Sunday best to watch you burn at the stake. It's not like, yeah, man. Yeah.
So you've talked a lot about politics on the show so far and politicians, and I know in the past we've discussed that you have interest in getting into politics yourself.
Yes.
Do you want to maybe talk about that a little bit and kind of tell your audience what you have in mind?
So 5 years, I plan on running for Senate in Mississippi. And obviously it's a long shot. I get that. But there's a few things I think it accomplishes, even if I don't win. One of them is, like we were talking earlier, communicating attention to the masses, communicating what we want to do to the people. It shows that we have a plan and we have a direction, and we're not just screaming into the void. But it also kind of lends us this sense of legitimacy that we can't be defamed as being other things, which is something that we have struggled with, as we talked about too, from the very beginning. People are always trying to throw a label at you as something. They're a gang, they're terrorists, they're this, they're that. But if you do something like this, where you can define yourself as a, no, we're a political party, we're running candidates now, then I'm working with some folks that are building the National Socialist American Party, and they got other guy wants to run in another state, and you know, we're just working on this. Is in the baby stage, right? I have a 5-year plan to run, but I think that Mississippi is a great place to do it. The racist history there is extremely strong. There was pro-segregation politicians being elected when 16% of the current population of voters was old enough to vote. So they were already, the people, a significant percentage of the people alive have already voted for white supremacists and got them in office. So there's this chance, perhaps, that this new wave of racism mixed with the old is most likely to occur at the biggest overlap in Mississippi, you know. And obviously people are going to say, well, there's a lot of Negroes in Mississippi. I get that. But there's a lot less Negroes in Mississippi than there was when Mississippi created total white supremacy. They did that with 40% of the population being white, and it was established and held in stone for multiple generations, almost 100 years. So it's the average black population has almost halved in comparison to the whole as it was back then. So it's on a good path, in my opinion, but really I just think it's a good place. It's where I'm from. It just makes the most sense for me personally. I love Mississippi history. I study it a lot. So I think it's a lot of great things have happened. Mr. Jefferson Davis was from Mississippi, you know, a lot of extremely important politicians that were part of the racist history of this country came from my state. So, yeah, that's the goal. Run there. Worst case scenario is it's still going to have massive media attention. And we will have our organization known by a lot more people, which is really, like I was saying at the beginning, one of the biggest part of the tricks is becoming known. Becoming known is very difficult, man. Becoming a household name, you have to break through. So I think that it would be a really good tool for that. We're gonna announce a rally in advance, possibly up to a year in advance. Get a permit to hold it. It'll be something that I want everybody to come to, even you, but, and then we'll go out there and have a shindig. I'll try to do whatever I can to get other guys from other countries like Johannes Eigenbach or, you know, Tom Sewell or Justin Barrett or all those guys. If we, by that time, could just buy them all tickets and throw a big old shindig with a bunch of speeches, and it would attract all kinds of races from all over the country. Hopefully we would have much bigger numbers. I would hope in 5 years to have 200 guys, kind of like PF does now. And the seething masses will show up in great number. And then we'll just have a big banner that says vote poll house for Senate. And it will be on every single media outlet for extended period of time. Which is really the trick when it comes to breaking through in politics is the media. And as you know, like the winner of an election is usually decided by who had the most money to spend on media. So we have a unique advantage in that whenever we do action in a state, we control the media for a long time. There was a period in Maine where every single news outlet was talking about me for months. So, I mean, every newspaper, every news station, every radio station, every periodical, everybody in Maine was talking about me. So, and I didn't even do a rally in Maine. So, yeah, it's a unique advantage that we can lean into. Got a lot of benefits and just a good goal for 5 years from now.
Sounds like a nice game plan. And I hope you're able to succeed. I think that would be a massive change in this country to have somebody who's an outright national socialist as a senator. That would be
just filibustering and causing all sorts of hell up there, man. Oh yeah,
it'd be quite something. You know, we haven't seen like a serious national socialist politician in this country before. You know, even Rockwell, you know, he tried, but he didn't actually achieve serious office. To have somebody overtly National Socialist achieve office would be – that in itself would mark a really big change for the direction of things.
That's another thing is it could spark other people to be inspired to try, other people to be inspired to vote for someone like that. And in Mississippi, Cindy Hyde-Smith won – I believe she's a senator in Mississippi. She won with 700,000 votes, which is not that many votes. And you only have – well – you have to have 1,000 signatures to get on the ballot. That would take us some work. We'll have to hit the street. But the fun thing is that I can't even run technically on the ballot as National Socialist until I have in the past received 20% of a vote. So until then, I have to appear on the ballot as Chris Pohlhaus Independent. So the petition we go around with will just say Chris Pohlhaus Independent. What are some things he thinks? Oh, he's real into national security and, you know, the fiscal responsibility. You know, just get a bunch of signatures. Get on the ballot. Just to get on the ballot, man, that would be so good. But, yeah, to win, Golly.
Yeah, that would be quite a change, quite a change of events. I want to talk maybe a little more about National Socialism, because I think this is, again, such a key topic where, yeah, I'm in full agreement with you that this is the solution for our problems that we have. You know, a lot of people are still afraid to get there. They're afraid to call themselves such. You know, they're like sentimental. You know, you actually get a lot of people in our camps now. They're like, oh, I'm a fascist, right? They're like,
which means almost nothing.
Right, right. They're trying. Like they're. I know a lot of these guys personally, where they're like, oh, I'm a fascist, and they read all of the National Socialist literature and they love Hitler, but they're like, I'm a fascist. You know, like I don't want to do the swastika yet. They're not ready, but they know that it's right. You know, so as that tide keeps turning and people keep coming further in this direction, they'll get more comfortable pulling themselves into here. So. One of the big things that is discussed a lot, you know, I run a National Socialist space on JQ Radio every other Monday, and I answer questions for 2 hours about National Socialism. I teach people about it, educate people about it. One of the biggest questions I get is Americans asking me, how can National Socialism be implemented in America? Is it compatible with America, and how do we use it, you know, here moving forward? A lot of people have this conception. And you kind of negated this earlier, which I agree with your negation, that they have this conception that it's just purely a German thing and it only works for the German people. How can this be implemented in America in your eyes? And is this only a German thing? I know you already said no, but I'll let you elaborate.
Right. Sure. So first of all, whatever happens in this country, if you want to affect change and create an outcome that I agree with in some way, all right, if you want to find common ground with me and create a system that affects change, it will require an absolute and total revolution of political thought in this country. It will require massive repeals of just mountains of laws and amendments, etc. It would create it's a huge project, but it has to be done. So that being said, is National Socialism compatible? The project of instilling those programs in America isn't any more difficult than doing any other big major change that is required. You know, I think ever since the Civil War, we've been spiraling into this massive just – you know, amalgamation of despair and disaster that has grown into this giant pustule absorbing everything around it. And in order to, you know, get things, even if you just wanted to go back, even if you just wanted to go back to, like, you know, original constitution, it would take serious, serious, serious revolution and work. So the argument that they're making is that to replace that system with a National Socialist system would be somehow more difficult than anything that they're going to replace it with, which is absolutely absurd and ludicrous because the creation part of it is not the obstacle. The obstacle is the elimination, is the removal of what is now. That is the real obstacle, the repealing and the destruction of this just, you know, Leviathan. That's the project that requires the immense effort. What we put in replace of that, that is honestly, at that point, if you've achieved total revolution, that's, at that point, you're just giving orders, right? You've already got there. So the only question that you could really have is, can I get the support for National Socialism from the masses? Can I achieve consent of the masses like Hitler did and instilling these different programs that I would believe, and then the people you're referencing would even argue in behind closed doors, is superior, right? Like you said, they say they're fascist, but they read National Socialist literature. So the question is, how do you get consent of the masses for a program that looks, smells, feels, touches, sounds exactly like National Socialism, but doesn't have the swastika and doesn't say National Socialism, right? Like, how do you, my argument would be, how do you get consent without just being honest? Because word is just going to get around that that's basically National Socialism. And you, instead, you act, it's trying to sell this to folks. You were trying to act like a coward instead of just being upfront and honest and saying, this is why we think it, that these systems were superior. So, the only, in my opinion, because this gets thrown out a lot, really, you know, like, oh, how is this going to work in America? Well, how is anything going to work in America? How is what's happened? How is what they've created now going to work in America? Nothing is going to work in America until some extreme major changes occur. And yeah, you can do all kinds of destruction of the system. You can repeal, you know, all sorts of amendments. But if in the end you're still a financial slave to international bankers, you didn't do nothing. You didn't do nothing. If at the end that your people still aren't prioritizing their genetic health and hygiene, you haven't done nothing, right? If in the end your people are still weak and degenerate, you haven't done shit. What is the point? Why even struggle for it? Why do I even want to work towards anything that doesn't deliver all of those points that National Socialism delivers? I don't see how anyone could have the will to fight for those things. And much more, I don't see anything else that has the martyrdom, the energy behind it that National Socialism does. Your little infinite fringe groups and ideas don't, right? What is big now in, you know, on X and on, you know, other social medias, even Instagram now? National Socialism, that's what's hot. That's what's cool. That's the thing. So you don't have the martyrs. You don't have the heroes, if with anything else. You don't have the powerful symbology, which we have proven to work. George Lincoln Rockwell has proven that it works. You know, you don't even have the good ideas, like the, you know, solutions, if you'd use something else. So I don't even see the point in trying. Right? What is there to fight for? I guess that's my long answer there, is that, you know, it's easy to say a job looks difficult, therefore it's not worth trying because sitting around's easier and giving up is easier. But in my world, working towards anything other than total victory is an absolute waste of your life.
Very well said. And I think you draw a really important point about, you know, reforming compared to revolution. You know, a lot of people that are not yet ready for National Socialism or not yet even ready for fascism, right? You got like these kind of like boomer conservative, actually they're more right than boomer conservatives. They're kind of like this 1776 again camp, right? Yeah. You know, like, let's reform it all back to where it was. And I think, you know, I understand their sentiment, and I appreciate it, but I think they have a lack of understanding of historical, how societals rise and collapse. You know, like, yeah. Ancient Rome, for example. Like, Rome was a great republic, and when the republic started to decay, it wasn't people that went republic again that fixed that country. It was people that cried for revolution, and they got a tyrant in, who was, you know, a one and only, and he came in and he stepped in with authority and he fixed the things one by one. And slowly it could become a republic again, but it can't be there when it's in this state of decay and it's in this, you can't reform something. It's like a cancerous tumor, right? You can't just keep chopping the cancer off and then it spreads back and you chop it off. Eventually you're going to run out of flesh to chop off. And you're going to ruin your body, right? You need to actually extract the tumor and create something new next to it, right? That is not plagued by this cancer. I think people fail to really understand that it's going to take revolutionary politics to fix the circumstances that we're in. That is why the conservatives and the 1776ers, they're not ever going to be adequate solutions because they want reform. They want to keep the same thing that is already corrupted from the inside out. They just want to reform it so that it's less corrupt, so that it's more reasonable to work with. And that's that corruption will always come back because the system itself is flawed.
Well, yeah, and I touched on this earlier that these things were debated back then. There was no 100% consensus on any of these ideas that the 76ers are proclaiming as gospel. Back then, they didn't think it was gospel. This is a great example right here. So this, John C. Calhoun, I've been reading a lot about him lately, Disquisition of Government. John C. Calhoun, amazing American politician. I don't know if you know anything about him, but you know, his argument on government, right? So government, he's basically like, the government will always exist. Government is a product of society. The people get together, they create a society. The society is full of basically selfish interests. And because of these competing selfish interests, there's got to be some sort of ruling authority that can, you know, act in essentially violent manners to, subdue those different things that society has agreed, steps out of line that works for them. But the problem is you have to create this ultimate power, and that ultimate power is an attractant for the, you know, nefarious, Machiavellian, self-interested, self-aggrandizing, avaricious, you know, those sorts of people. So what is it that you put in this? How do you build a system with the checks that, you know, you have to create the absolute power, but you also put in the guidelines for it that keep it from turning into what it turns into now. Obviously, they failed at that project, right? They obviously failed at that project somewhere along the line. Now, I talk about the Civil War a lot because the Civil War is where things change in this country from being Confederacy of states, sovereign independent states, into something very nationalized and centralized, which was the main fear of the people who were signing the goddamn Constitution in the first place. So now, the thing is, like, what are we supposed to be proud of when the thing that they were debating upon, or not necessarily proud of, but what are we supposed to be prioritizing as 1776 guys? What are we supposed to be prioritizing when even those guys who were basically split down the middle, like the almost 50-50 on the votes on these problems, were debating things like, you know, centralization and all that, when they've been vindicated at this point. So we've reached this point now to where the people, the great statesmen of the past, have been vindicated. We don't have to look back and pick the guys that weren't. We can look back to our history and look towards the guys like Calhoun that were vindicated, you know, like Jefferson Davis that were vindicated. These men were right. Some people were wrong. We can do that. We can still have a sense of national pride. Look towards the guys that were right. Look at their arguments. Use their arguments to build our new system, and it still be National Socialist.
That's a extremely well stated. We're coming up on the last 20 minutes or so here, so I want to maybe allow you a chance to, if there's anything that you wanted to discuss or bring up on your behalf, on what your group is doing, anything that you would like to bring to the attention of my audience while we've got about 10 or 15 minutes here, and then we'll do a little bit of an outro. I'll promote your stuff again so people can find you. So your floor, if there's anything you want to discuss.
I think the Stu Peters audience is, they're really savvy on the Jew, right? So, which is great. You know, being Jew-pilled is great. But after you've crossed a threshold, you're aware. And now what's left? You can sit there and cry about them all day, every day. We can complain about Jews until we go extinct. Or you can work towards a creative solution. You can work on advancing your own understanding of history, of statesmanship, and, you know, National Socialism is what I would, obviously promote, but even if, you wanted to focus on some of these other Americans that have been vindicated, do that. Find some literature to dig into and start to build yourself up as a statesman. So imagine that that's your project. And the reason I'm saying that is because ultimately, those of us who are aware at this point, we have to be. We have been, Providence has dictated that our responsibility is to, if not become the statesman of the future, to train and help the evolution in the production and the cultivation of the statesman of the future. That is our main objective, and that's one of the reasons I really like your work, because there's few people who speak on National Socialism with the eloquence and profundity that you do, and I appreciate that a lot. So it's something that we need to all work on together as a collective project. Maybe take personal inventory of the time that you're spending in your day doing things that maybe like consuming Netflix slop or, flipping endlessly through Twitter just to complain about Jews all day. I'm as guilty as anybody. But find some time to dedicate to put your phone down and put your little ignorant face in a book, because there is a lot to learn, and when you start to unfold the past and you start to understand these things, then you can really win the arguments in a really different way, and we can get back to, the answer to the big question is, how do we make this stuff happen? Well, we read the smart men, we read the examples of the smart men that fixed things in the past. And we read the things that they read, even. Right? You go back, what are they sourcing? Because they source things. Look up the sources. Read those, right? Calhoun, for example, when he was a young man, he read so much when his father, it might have been his mother or sister or something, he had a death in the family, and it affected him so much. I think at that point he was orphaned. I think it was his mom, but he read so much he was emaciated. He got possessed by it because it was like, I have the responsibility of the family now. His dad was an important statesman. He was like the gifted kid. I have to become the man now. I have to learn these things. Well, essentially, that's the kind of attitude that we all need to have, because it is our responsibility at this point. We are orphans in a way. Yeah, we got parents, but they all kind of suck. All of our parents are kind of lacking. Your parent might be great. Someone else's parent might be great. But ultimately, are they though? Were they really instilling these things into you as a young kid? So we're orphans in a way. You had to take this time, absorb as much as you can, crystallize this knowledge in your head, and turn it into something beautiful, so that we can work on this project together, because it is a collaborative effort. We got to work together. We have to find exactly what it is we agree upon in every sense of the word. We have to get a consensus, and we have to march forward with that unchanging, eyes on the horizon, with blinders on, nothing distracting us, getting after it. So yeah, I guess that's my big thing, and it's my big message to people. In general, lately, it's my focus in my streaming now. I read every night to my folks, and I'm going through 7 different books right now through the streams and trying to increase my own knowledge. And, I'm trying to take my own medicine here that I'm given. So, yeah.
It's a very good message, one that I frequently push on my show. So I'm happy to hear that you're doing the same, because, we get this divide sometimes, I think, from, I don't see it as much, actually, as I used to, but about a year ago or so, this divide was very common between activist and intellect, right? It's like you either have to be a guy on the streets or you have to be a guy that's a bookworm. And I think it's really important that we have this duality, this true ancient concept of the philosopher warrior. Right.
Yes.
To combine these two is a very dangerous combo in a good way. Right. Dangerous to the Jewish system in that sense. And I think that needs to be pushed very seriously. And we need to I agree that there is a problem with armchair intellectuals. They certainly exist, like your Jared Taylors, right, who they want to talk about it all day. They want to say things about it, but he's not going to talk about the real issues. He's not going to get involved in serious change, right? So he could be as intellectual as he wants, you know, but without action, without doing something around the knowledge that he has, the knowledge is worthless, right? So idle knowledge is worthless, but also you know, active stupidity is equally worthless. So you need to bring those two concepts together. I think that's a very good message.
Yeah, the old saying, action speaks louder than words. Nobody's disagreed with that one.
Yeah. You
know, nobody's ever disagreed with that one. It's true. You know, words are very important, but yeah, we got to get to work. And I'm going to tell you right now, organizing guys is work. I feel like the HR department for neo-Nazis. No, I hate that term, neo-Nazis. It was funny. But yeah, I mean, organizing people is a lot of work. And you might not think it is. And the problem with you not thinking it is that you're putting off this work that needs to get done now. We need to organize folks. I mean, one thing I like to tell people is if we had revolution tomorrow, we couldn't run the waste department, the waste management department. We couldn't run the national parks. So what does that say about us, right? And I'm not just saying me as in Blood Tribe. I'm saying us as a movement. We don't have the organizational capacity to run the waste management service of this country. That's a problem.
Yeah.
Right? And until we can fix that problem, we don't even deserve power. We don't even deserve it. We haven't earned it yet. So getting to organize, finding out who's the boss of your area, finding out a banner to march under, and people to get with, and to create a cohesive unit, because those units absorb each other over time. Be willing to that as well. Realize that, okay, now that I've got my, you know, I've got my collective figured out. We got 10 to 15 guys, but Blood Tribe is looking like they're doing great. You know, Hammer just, you got 30% of the vote in Mississippi. Maybe we should just consider, you know, joining them. Have that consideration in the future to consolidate. But if you're afraid of, because this the unknown, you know, who to join and whatever, that doesn't mean that you're exempt from organization. That means you're just going to have to do it yourself. And it's a lot of work. It is tedious. So you got to get to doing it. We have to get it done.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a very good closing point. I think that's very, very good message for us to end on. I don't want to dilute that message by going any further with any other points.
Cool.
So what I want to do again, I want to give you one more chance to promote your socials, your organization, anything that you want to promote that you're doing, throw it out there so that the audience can find you, support you, join you, whatever they would like to do.
Sure. The best thing is obviously Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it. My handle on there once again is YEEE, three E's. _ I add an E every time I get banned. _ OLE _ Hammer. EO Hammer. Okay. And we have a vetting email. Okay. So if you're looking to get vetted to join us, which is honestly the best way you could contribute, means way more to me than donating, means way more to me than anything else, is contributing on foot. If you're willing to do that, our email is blutstom@protonmail.com. That's blutstamm@protonmail.com. It's on my X, if you forget it. And, you know, I stream on 5 different platforms every night. I post that on X, though, so it's just a good first front door for you. I tend to post everything on there. So get a hold of me on there. Get a hold of us on the email. If you were looking to support us in our fight against the ADL, givesandgo.com/BT vs. VS ADL. ADL. So BT versus ADL. Any help we can get, we're trying to make that happen. So yeah, hit us up.
All right, awesome. Thank you for coming on. This has been great. And folks, in the audience, please don't forget to follow Hammer on all of his different platforms. Help him out where you can. Follow me as well if you're not following me already. We're on Odyssey. We're on Rumble. FTJmedia.com. We're streaming on Entropy. We're everywhere. We're on the Stu Peters networks. Make sure you're following me on everything. Share my stuff around. That's the best way that you can help my show. If you want to go that extra mile, if you really enjoy these conversations and you want to keep seeing these going in the future, financial support helps keep this show going, and it's always greatly appreciated. You can do super chats on Rumble, Odyssey, FTJ. I always recommend that you do it on FTJ. They have a 0% processor fee, so there's no Jewish middleman taking our money. I really appreciate that about them. So if you do want to support, FTJ is always a really good avenue to do that. With that said, we're going to close it up. So thank you, folks, again for watching. Thank you, brother, for coming on. This was a wonderful show. And I'll see you guys on Monday. We'll be live at 4 p.m. Eastern with Chapter 3 of Mein Kampf. So I'm looking forward to that one.
Awesome.
All right. Have a good night, folks.
See y'all.
Okay.